This is Greater LA, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Janaea Williams, in for Steve Chiatakis, on this Juneteenth holiday. Today, Juneteenth is one of three new holidays we're observing for the first time this year in California. The other two state holidays that just became official in 2023 are the Lunar New Year and Genocide Remembrance Day in April. And I should say it's just been made official here and at the federal level last year. But Juneteenth is also considered one of the longest running holidays in America, usually celebrated around the third weekend in June to commemorate the end of slavery for African Americans back in 1865. And it's called Juneteenth because as the Civil War ended and enslaved people were set free, it wasn't until June 19th, 1865, when the news of emancipation finally reached Galveston, Texas, more than 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was issued. June 19th became Juneteenth, and since that time, African-American people and families have marked the day with cookouts, parades, parties, music, food, all kinds of general celebrations of culture and resilience. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. But first, we're going to have a conversation with two people who are working on the issue of reparations for African-American people here in California and elsewhere. Dr. Cheryl Grills is a member of the statewide task force that's been studying the issue of reparations, which is the first of its kind in the country. She's also a professor at Loyola Marymount University. And she joins me now along with Kavon Ward, who's a co-founder of Where Is My Land, an organization that's working on reclaiming Black land across the U.S. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having me and happy Juneteenth.
Thank you. Same here. Happy Juneteenth.
So, Dr. Grills, let me start with you. Can you just tell me quickly a little more about California's Reparations Task Force? Like, what are the goals and what have you worked on so far? Just a little overview.
Sure. The California Reparations Task Force was established 2 years ago. We have a 2-year time frame to essentially study the issue of harms done from enslavement to the present. Against African Americans, the harms done to us in a number of different areas. And then from that, to educate the public about our findings, to come up with ways to calculate harm in terms of compensation, to also align, come up with a set of recommendations that align with the basic standards that must be met by the United Nations. To be considered bona fide reparations, to craft an apology, and to issue a set of recommendations for the legislature and the governor to consider. We will be releasing the final report on June 29th in Sacramento to the state legislature and the governor. At that point, on July 1st, actually, we sunset as a task force, but that's when the real good hard work starts, which is tracking and monitoring the legislature's response to the over 115 recommendations for repair that we are proposing.
Mm-hmm. And Kavon, your organization is taking kind of a different approach in that you're not necessarily working with the legislature to meet your goals. So can you talk a little bit about what Where Is My Land does and why you've chosen to approach the idea of reparations in the way that you have?
Absolutely. So Where Is My Land is a national organization focused on helping Black people across the country reclaim land stolen from them. And so we do actually work with legislature, legislature, city, state, and if need be, federal, to see if there can be some type of policy change that would allow for folks to reclaim land safely, Black people to reclaim land safely. And it is an outgrowth of a local grassroots initiative called Justice for Bruce's Beach. It is what I started back in Juneteenth of 2020, focused solely on getting land back for the Bruce family. And as you may or may not know, the land was returned to the Bruce family in 2021 and sold back to the county back in 2022. But when the governor signed
let me back up a little bit. Let me back up a little bit. Just I want to get you to explain what you mean by land stolen from them.
Yeah, absolutely. Racially motivated theft, like using policies that were actually legal, like eminent domain, but we know that eminent domain disproportionately affects Black people mm-hmm. within Black communities. And so what the city of Manhattan Beach did was they got upset, essentially the people and the policymakers were upset that this Black couple, Charles and Willa Bruce, were taking up space in a predominantly white community and actually flourishing business-wise. Mm-hmm. And so after attempts to shut them down, to scare them away, after those attempts did not work, the city use eminent domain to steal the land from the Bruce family and other Black families within the city of Manhattan Beach.
Right. Okay.
But most recently, it was returned back to the Bruce family.
Right. And you were really critical of the family's decision to sell it back for around $20 million after it was returned. So why did that rub you the wrong way? And so many people, you and so many other people.
I mean, it rubbed me the wrong way because, the community help that family get the land back. We had boots on the ground. And the community did not win from it. And my vision was that, Black people would be able to take up space in a predominantly white Manhattan Beach. And so I thought that there would be opportunities for Black entrepreneurs to start more businesses, more Black people to be able to live there with affordable housing. Because as some of you may know, Manhattan Beach is a very wealthy community, and it's very white. And so I lived there for about 3 years and really just felt a disconnect and a discomfort living in a predominantly white community. And I almost felt as if I wasn't wanted there. And I think that's indicative of less than 1% of Black people that lived in that city, that continue to live in that city. And so for me, when the land was sold, it meant that there would not be Black people taking up space in a predominantly white community. It meant that the community would not win. It just meant that the family won. And it was just disappointing for me.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Grills, I want to go back to you and the task force, because there's been some criticism of the task force for even existing, but a lot of people weren't nearly as critical of reparations for other groups like Japanese Americans, for the experience of being put into internment camps during World War II. The U.S. government gave more than $1.6 billion in reparations money to Japanese Americans, which is about $20,000 per person it ended up being. So do you see some kind of double standard at work here, or what do you think is behind that?
I absolutely see a double standard when it comes to reparations for Black folks. It's as though there's this anti-Black knee-jerk reaction when you hear Black folk and you hear compensation. Mm-hmm. No. When you hear Black folk and you hear wrongs done and racism and racial stress and trauma. No, get over it. Stop playing the race card. So, we as a society, we have not yet come to terms, not just with the original sin of enslavement and what was done against Native Americans and other groups. We have as a country pretty much covered up the truth about the history of this country. And so then when people are confronted with ideas related to reparations for Black folk, they're like, reparations for what? People don't understand the through line that what happened during enslavement didn't end with emancipation. It just, the levels of oppression just morphed and mutated. And while everybody wants to talk about all the harms done to Black folk, which are true, and need to be addressed, people don't pay as much attention to the fact that white folks were damaged too in this process. Hmm. They were fed a false sense of who they are and their relevance and centrality in American life. They were sold a bill of goods about who we are as Black people so that they could feel a measure of status that says, I may be poor, but at least I'm not Black.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It creates a mindset where white folks will even do things against their own best interests in order to maintain this mindset. So, yes, there are a lot of naysayers, and I think that they are. It's grounded in both misinformation and dismissal of information, and also on the grounds of a kind of a false identity and perhaps a compromised humanity from being in the midst of so much racial oppression.
Okay, so because it is Juneteenth and I do want to focus on the positive a little bit, I want to give both of you a chance to answer this question of where you have found hope through your work. And Kavon, do you want to go first?
I mean, what gave me hope was the fact that one Black family finally got their land back. And it also gives me hope that the families, I think we're working with about, well, we've got submissions for about 700 families. They have, you know, they have more hope as a result of that land return. So they keep me inspired. And then the youth keep me inspired. And so that gave me a lot more hope. And folks are just tired, you know, folks are tired. And I like that people are more motivated. And yes, it's because of, you know, harmful reasons that they're motivated, but I like to see so many people, Black people working in community. And then the fact that there's a lot of like Asian allies, I want to see it progress. And I want to see it implemented in a way where we can say, okay, you know, thank you for that one Black family, but now all these Black families, this policy created so that all Black families stand a chance as it relates to reclaiming their land.
Dr. Grills, what do you feel optimistic about in the work that you do?
I had teach a class at Loyola Marymount University called African and Black Psychology. And I have to say, these young students have given me hope for the future. I feel like we are in good hands with the up-and-coming generation. Their analysis is sharp. Their commitment to truth and justice is unquestionable. And their ability to articulate the issues leaves you full. You know, your heart and your mind are full. And so I've watched them. I watched them in Ghana. I took them to Ghana last 2 weeks ago for a study abroad as the culmination of their class.
Wow.
And they came to terms with the Holocaust of African enslavement in the dungeons. They felt the pain. They smelt the horror and the terror. And they were able to do that in a way that didn't harden their hearts. It deepened their compassion, not only for their ancestors, but for all people, which is our African way. In other words, I saw them lean more into being African and all of the values and the principles therein that will ensure that we have a society that is grounded in humanity and compassion and sense of responsibility for one another.
Wonderful. Dr. Cheryl Grills, Kavon Ward, thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
There are so many events happening here in LA for Juneteenth. You can celebrate with food, drinks, music, art, you name it. And of course, one of the most popular events is the Leimert Park Juneteenth Festival in Leimert Park Village. In a few minutes, we'll check in with a chef who's serving up some delicious Southern food today, including some traditional Juneteenth fare in Leimert Park. But first, I made a stop at Grant AME Church on Central Avenue in Watts to hear how they're celebrating Juneteenth. The Afro-American Chamber Music Society Orchestra is here, performing work from Black classical composers. There's African Suite by Nigerian composer Fela Sowande and Echoes from the Journey by Zenobia Powell Perry. And Cape Coast Castle Symphony by composer Joyce Solomon Moorman tells the origin story of African-Americans in two parts, starting in Africa and ending in America. It was inspired by Moorman's trip to the Cape Coast Castle in Ghana almost 10 years ago.
It was the most amazing site that we visited. I went with a friend. The tour guide asking us to look up at the top of this huge wooden door. And it said, door of no return. And then when the door opened, it opened to the seashore, which was lined with fishing boats. And then after we looked around at the boats and the fishermen mending their nets, he asked us to turn around and look at the top of the door again. And the top of the door said, the door of return. And so that made me feel like, oh, Ghana is welcoming those who went out, our ancestors, so to speak, of African Americans, right, who were shipped out in the 1700s and 1800s. And now we're coming back to visit our ancestral home. They were welcoming us back. We were returning. And so the symphony is in two movements. The first movement is the Door of No Return. The first movement is set in my imagination in the 1700s, right? So the overall feeling I feel should be one of sadness, right? And then the second movement is the Door of Return. So the Door of Return is African Americans returning to visit Africa. You have an African percussion section performing. You have the conga drum, you have cowbell, and you have a shakari playing. And, you know, this is the Africans welcoming the African Americans. And so the second movement is meant to be a happy movement. The second movement is a celebratory movement. Happiness at our returning home to our ancestral homeland, right? Africa. Of course, Juneteenth is celebrating our freedom from slavery.
And finally, on this Juneteenth, let's get into something that's important for every good celebration, and that's food. I'm here now with Ranika Conley. She also goes by Neek, and she's the owner and head chef of the pop-up restaurant Angels and Saints Po' Boys. Hey, Neek, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. How are you?
I'm good. So you're from New Orleans originally, right?
Absolutely, born and raised.
So I feel like Juneteenth is celebrated a little differently in the South. So can you talk about what it meant to you growing up and what it looked like?
You know, for me, Juneteenth was more of a celebration of our discovery of freedom. You know, it's the story of Juneteenth is we were free for 2 years before we even knew that we were actually free. And being that we celebrate that announcement, for me, it's just a discovery process. And I think in the South, you know, we tend to explore different flavors and, you know, different ways to feed and nourish our family. So it's more of a space of discovery for me. Again, from New Orleans. So, of course, food is the centerpiece of everything we do. So, you know, it just really depends on, you know, your family and your tribe. You know, we celebrate with soul food. There's also the color of red and trying to incorporate that into our food. And then, again, for me, discovery. So just trying new dishes and, you know, making sure that we feed and nurture our families and be grateful for everything that's come since that day.
Okay. Well, you said a little bit of it, but I'm going to back up and just ask, how does food fit into Juneteenth for you?
Well, you know, food is always a space of fellowship, right? And if we're celebrating and we're experiencing this freedom and this ability to become greater than what we are, I think the cornerstone of that is fellowship and, you know, just rallying around each other, supporting each other, letting each other know, like, we're here for each other. We love each other and we just want to be and prosper and just be amazing in everything that we do. And I think sitting around the table, you know, breaking bread and sharing those moments and, you know, still getting that good nurturing and that feeding of the soul and the body is what Juneteenth is about.
That's beautiful. Okay, so you talked about this a little bit. You touched on this a little earlier, but Let's talk about red foods, which is a thing with Juneteenth, right? Yeah. Traditionally, people serve red foods on the holiday. So where does that come from and what's the significance of the color red?
So the color red, as you know, of course, Juneteenth is a celebration of the slaves from Africa that were brought over to America being told about their freedom. But those slaves have an origin with the Yoruba tribes and the Congo tribes. And in those tribes, red is a very powerful spiritual color. So when we go into these spiritual rituals and different spiritual celebrations, color is big for us. So when we're trying to garner the spirit and the atmosphere of power, red is one of those colors. Some chefs also say, you know, that it represents the bloodshed of our ancestors who, you know, who died and gave their lives so that we could be here to celebrate this freedom, to explore this freedom and to maximize this freedom. So, you know, red just has a really, really, really powerful meaning within Juneteenth, and we just try to incorporate it any way we can. So whether it's a strawberry soda or it's a red velvet cake or hot links or barbecue or anything that has that deep, rich redness in it, we try to bring that into the Juneteenth celebrations.
Okay, right. So red velvet cake was the only thing I could think of when I was thinking of red foods. I had to decide whether I was going to out myself as a Black person who doesn't like red velvet cake. And I hope I don't lose my Black card, but I don't like it.
You're not alone.
I'm happy you mentioned those other foods.
Yeah, you're not alone. I am not a red velvet fan.
You're not a red velvet fan either?
I am not. You know, I can get slaughtered for that, but no, it's not one of my favorites, but...
Okay, so run down the other foods. For those of us who don't like red velvet cake, some of the other foods that you mentioned.
I mean, you want to tap into, you know, it doesn't have to be like a bright red. Ruby reds are great. You can tap into hibiscus flowers. Again, barbecue is one of our staples. We also, you know, drinks, the sodas. There's a Juneteenth punch, which is amazing. It's made out of strawberry sherbet and different fruit juices and ginger ale and, you know, things like that, which, you know, ginger ale is a staple in our diaspora. So, you know, just adding that in. So, you know, however you can incorporate it in is always, you know, whether it's, you know, adding strawberries to your fruit salad or throwing some cherries on top of your ice cream after your meal is you just want to make sure that you channel that color and you reflect on what that color brings into your life.
Okay, wonderful. And I hope the ancestors aren't frowning on us for our food preferences. So I hear you're out serving up food today. So what's on the menu and where are you?
Well, Angels and Saints specializes in traditional New Orleans style po' boys. So we have our traditional five out today in Leimert Park. You can get a shrimp, catfish, roast beef, which is the original po' boy, and hot sausage. And we also have some etouffees and gumbos, which are staples of the New Orleans cuisine, as well as some original dishes. We have our houdette bowl, which, of course, is sprinkled with red peppers and it's beautiful red crawfish rice with spinach and catfish and shrimp and my signature Creole sauce. So we have a wide spread. We have vegan options. We want to make sure that we tap into everyone because we want to feed and just nurture as many people in our community as possible, especially during a time of celebration such as Juneteenth.
Yum. Now I'm hungry. Did you say where you were?
We are out in Leimert Park. There's huge concerts, lots of family events and things out in Leimert Park in the Los Angeles area of California.
I've been talking with Ronika Conley. She also goes by Neek, and she's the owner and chef over at Angels and Saints Po' Boys. Thank you so much, Neek, for talking with me today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Happy Juneteenth to you.
Exactly. I'll let you get back to the fun. That does it for our Juneteenth episode of Greater LA. Christian Bordahl, Juliana Mayo, Jay Siebold, Michael Stark, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, and Amy Ta all helped to put this episode together. Thank you so much for your time and have a very, very happy Juneteenth.